Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here in the Oriental Institute at the invitation of the Oxford Centre of Vaishnava Studies. Thank you for inviting me. I have only my text with me, having decided against making my lecture illuminating or entertaining by way of slides or PowerPoint. As you know, Microsoft's PowerPoint is a very convenient way of giving lectures, and indeed with a good overhead digital projector, a wonderful way of showing images. And it's very easy to do close-ups and isolated details, but if there is a fault anywhere in the system, or as happened to me the other day, one is suddenly told that thieves have wrenched the overhead projector off the ceiling, one is in a difficult situation. The illusory world one had planned to create is demolished. Slide projectors too go wrong. Rather than PowerPoint or slides, I'll seek the assistance of a brief prayer from Kalidasa's opening of the Raghuvamsha. I sing, which I'll just give in English, I sing the praises of Parvati and Parameshwara, the world's parents, who, like word and meaning, are united, that we may attain right knowledge of word and meaning. Eschewing technical uncertainties, hoping to replace them by divine certainties, I'm going to talk about pictures and iconography, visualization and projection with words alone. This lecture will make some demands on your imagination. Had I used a real projector, I would have had from the beginning projected on a screen behind me an image of Ganesha, a baby Ganesha on the verge of toddlerhood, reddy brown in colour, the representation in paint of a bronze image of the Lord of Beginnings. Let me leave this image in the air on the screen of your minds for a few minutes while I unpack my title a little. The Hindu imagination and imaginary Hinduisms. The boldness of the definite article, the Hindu imagination, is obviously tempered by the statement of the fact that there are imaginary Hinduisms. I'm not going to tell you what the Hindu imagination is. That giant task would be predicated on the impossible prerequisite of knowing what Hinduism is, but I will give some instances of it. Imaginary Hinduisms are much more easily dealt with than a single Hinduism, legion though they are. One such has recently been spelt out for us by Sharada Sankirta Raja's Imagining Hinduism, a post-colonialist account of the Western manufacture of an imaginary Hinduism. Ron Inden's Imagining India was, for the most part, an attempt to lay bare British and French creation of an imaginary Hinduism. Here, imaginary Hinduisms are counterpoised to more authentic Hinduisms. But it could well be argued, though I won't do so here, that all Hinduisms are imaginary in one way or another. I chose imagination for the theme of this lecture when the invitation came because I'm writing a book on what I call the classical Hindu imagination, notwithstanding perhaps dubious connotations of the concept of the classical nowadays. That book will comprise studies of particular manifestations of Hindu imagination, poetry and religious texts connected with visual works of art, for instance Kalidasa's poems, Shiva Nataraja and the Devi Mahatmya and so on, detailed studies of particular exemplifications of imaginative power. My first intention for this lecture was to have a go at a more systematic analysis of imagination, but I have to some extent been sidetracked by a recent event, which I felt unable to ignore, an event relating to the Ganesha still being projected on the imaginary screen behind me and on the screen of your minds, to whom I will shortly direct my argument. But first, a little about imagination in general. By imagination, I mean Pratibha, Kalpana, Bhavana. In one way or another, these words all relate to bringing into being again, replicating in some way the work of the divine creator. Imagination is above all the sphere of the creative artist. The divine is often itself seen as artist, modelled on the human creator, who often sees themselves as replicating the divine bringing into being. There are two other important phenomena which parallel the work of creation, namely dreams and magic. These both produce a parallel creation of sorts, and all three are intimately connected, and this interconnection is subsumed within the word Maya. In modernity, the place of imagination is more varied. Benedict Anderson famously defined the nation as an imagined community. One reads of Hindu attacks upon Muslims as being expressions of the BJP's, quote, Hindu imagination. There was, and perhaps still is, the colonial imagination. What is the locus of these imaginations, in some tidal wave that sweeps across large bodies of people? Perhaps there is in some sense a continuum from what the individual imagines to what a group imagines and to what the nation imagines. Perhaps the factor of the lowest common denominator is important in the action of these waves. Perhaps the more negative emotion something brings with it, the further it will carry. Thus the anger fermented by certain Hindutva thinkers. It's instructive to consider for a moment the imagination of Savarkar, Vinayak Savarkar, who, as it happens, was named after Ganesha or Vinayaka. Whereas Gandhi spent his life exploring the application of Hinduism to politics and the relationship of Sanatana Dharma to other religions, Savarkar had little to say about the nature of Hinduism, which he saw as only one element of Hindu nationalism. In 1923, he published Hindutva, Who is a Hindu? Whereas one of Gandhi's favourite maxims from the Rig Veda was, may noble thoughts from all over the world come to us, Savarkar looked to the Veda as an early statement of a religious, racial, cultural and political unit. The nation was Savarkar's supreme truth. He declared that the Hindu nation was not a mushroom growth. It has grown out of this soil and has its roots stuck deep and wide in it. It is not a fiction invented despite the Muslims. But his language is revealing. Nationalism is precisely the mushroom growth of modernity springing up overnight from nowhere. Savarkar himself admitted that he was willing the Hindu nation into being. We Hindus will to be a nation, and therefore we are a nation. In similarly revelatory language, he refers to Hinduism as a creature from the deep, from what might be seen as the primordial depths of his imagination. During the last 5,000 years of its continuous growth and consolidation, says Savarkar, this gigantic octopus of Hindudom has clutched and crushed within the formidable grip of its mighty arms a number of Shakistans, Hunastans, a kingdom set up by invaders in India. Addressing himself to Muslims, he continued, the Marathas swallowed and gulped down your very empire entirely and altogether before it knew what was happening. However, the imagination in the sense that I want to discuss, and as referred to by Pratibha and the other Sanskrit words, is far removed from this general, in some sense, sociological or social version of imagination, which in Savarkar's very own image takes on a monstrous form. Though again, from the sociological perspective, praise of elite cultures masks the inequities on which the elite is built. Another scale of imagination would be from the human imagination to the divine imagination, from the single person's visualization of their Ishta Devata, say, to the world as the product of God's imagination. Without being an artist, perhaps the ordinary individual can be capable of imagining the beauty of the divine with great efficacy. The meditation upon the verbal iconography within the ritual text can produce mental images of great beauty without the person having the ability to reproduce their vision in the external world. More simply, the scale from small to large, from the Ishta Devata in one's personal shrine to the Vishwarupa of a deity, its universal form with infinite heads and limbs. Perhaps the most interesting scale to put imagination on is that of truth and falsity, from real to unreal. At one extreme, a false version of Hinduism, say a Baptist missionary's construct. At the other, the imagination of a Vedic seer or a Mahatma. But then again, is imagination necessary for, say, a Mahatma's understanding of Dharma? Well, imagination is necessary for the layman to seek to understand him as far as he may, but the Mahatma himself would perhaps have an intuitively correct understanding of whatever he thought to understand that would be to some extent a replication of the divine imagination. Or is this too tortuous? The Mahatma is simply God-man. Then again, there is a sliding scale between dream, magic, and imagination. The divine power of God's imagination, the particular transformations brought about by a magician or a conjurer, the magic transformation of reality brought about in dreams, the bringing to life brought about by a poet or artist. There's also the scale of convenience and desirability. There is imagination which does what you want it to do, and imagination that operates willy-nilly. In Kalidasa's court epic Kumarasambhava, Shiva at times performs magician-like acts for his own benefit. I'm thinking here of him turning his usual scary accoutrements into wedding ornaments. Or again, when, after his marriage, he carries Parvati, quote, heavy with the weight of her buttocks, her golden girdle dangling down, into a house of jewels, gleaming with luxurious items assembled by the power of his yogic meditation. End quote. Kalidasa is here imagining a magic power. An instance more crucial than the two just mentioned, just instance from the Kumarasambhava and more convenient, would be Sitar in the Adiatma Ramayana, creating a substitute Sitar and so avoiding the problems arising from her presence in Ravana's court, where an objection from the real world to the text is answered by altering the text. How to classify Rama's use of a golden image of Sitar in ritual after she's gone? A vital aspect of imagination in Hinduism is the role of the murti, the pratimar, as a support for the imagination. Darshana is inseparable from the imagination. Then there's the so much more energetic and uncontrollable energy of the folk tale that upsets and overthrows the so-called classical tradition, the folk tale where images come to life. Narayana Rao reports the song of Telugu Brahmin women about how the golden image of Sitar to be placed before Rama in the sacrifice must be bathed by Rama's sister, but she refuses to perform the bathing because she was not consulted when Sitar was abandoned. Another song, Narayana Rao mentions, tells how Shurpanakha, Ravana's sister, jealous of Rama's happiness in Ayodhya after killing her brother, creates a magic picture of Ravana, having got Sitar to draw his big toe, she only having ever looked at Ravana's feet. The picture takes on a life of its own. Ravana's image starts to try to drag Sitar back to Lanka. All the women in the palace try to help Sitar get rid of the painting, but fire won't burn it. They throw it into a well, but it pops back up. At last, Sitar subdues the image by uttering Rama's name. When Rama comes in, she hides the picture under the bed. Rama wants to make love, but Sitar is distracted, and finding the picture, Rama thinks she is in love with the dead Ravana and banishes her. And this story has a very great merit of giving a really good reason for Rama to banish Sitar. The women of the palace tell him what happened, but he won't listen and tells Lakshmana to take her to the forest and kill her. Where should we place the exuberant power of the folk imagination? Another important instance of imaginative power solving problems in a text is, of course, Krishna using his Maya to make the gopas think their wives are still at home when they're in fact they're dancing the Rasa dance with Krishna. Is this the imagination of the writer of the Bhagavata Purana or the divine power of Krishna? Of course, it's both, but seemingly a kind of afterthought. A fascinating instance of the power of yogis to create people is referred to by Adi Shankara in his commentary on the Brahma Sutras. Claiming to quote the Mahabharata, he tells us that the really competent yogi can create artificial beings, a kind of zombies, to work out his own karma more quickly, dividing it up between them. With due deference and apologies to the image of Ganesha, still manifest, I hope, on the screen of your imaginations, I want to look now at an imaginary Krishna, an entirely imaginary Krishna. So no image of Krishna is necessary here. His name is in fact Kritsna, and he is, or rather was, coupled with Christ. Krishna and Christ, Krishna spelt with an aspirated C and with a T inserted between the S and the N. I'm referring to the ideas of a now forgotten figure who wrote a book called Christ and Kritzner, a Frenchman called Louis Jacolliot. I use him here because his work is an entirely uncontentious example of imaginary Hinduism in a negative sense. Jacolliot's first and main work was The Bible in India. This work made some stir when it came out in 1869. Actually, it's very interesting also that there's a reference to Mother India. There's quite early as a reference to Mother India. But anyway, it was welcomed by Dayananda Saraswati and also considerably influenced Blavatsky in her Isis Unveiled, as did his Christ and Krishna, and another book, his Occult Science in India, this latter book relating his own direct experience of Indian magic. His comparison of Krishna and Christ arises from his persistence in keeping the Tamil transliteration of Krishna, which inserts the T. He first sets this out in the Bible in India and repeats it in Krishna and Christ, even after quoting himself in full a review of the former book by the Sanskritist Foucault, who points out the inconsequentiality of the Tamil spelling. But the linguistic details passed over Jacolliot's head. This is what Dayananda had to say about Jacolliot in his Satyat Prakashak. It is a fact that all the science and religions that are extant in the world originated in India and thence spread to other countries. Mr. Jacolliot, a native of France, tells us in his book, Bible in India, that India is a source of all kinds of knowledge and good institutions. All sciences and religions found in the world have spread from this country, India, that is, not France. Jacolliot prays to God thus, "Mayst thou, O Lord, raise my country to that height of civilization and progress that has been attained by India in ancient times." Jacolliot wrote some 13 books of what he called Indianist studies and 10 books recounting, so it seemed, his travels in India. Recent research has shown that he was in India only for just over 2 years. The Indianist studies are based on a complete ignorance of Indian languages and on gross forgeries prepared, it would seem, by some pundit willing to supply the information the credulous Jacolliot sought. Passages from the New Testament were put into an Indian guise to make it seem that Jesus was Krishna. Jacolliot is not without importance inasmuch as he provided material for Blavatsky, notably on the supposed powers of yogis, and played some small part in making Europe more receptive to Hinduism. In Jacolliot, we find a complex range of phenomena relating to imagination. He invents a whole series of travel books. He promulgates forged texts and false etymologies. He gives an eyewitness account of plainly faked magic tricks, such as levitation, all taken from the standard conjurer's repertoire. Here is someone we can all agree, surely, who fostered an imaginary Hinduism with a whole bookshelf of books. Though he is now forgotten, his utterly unscholarly presentation of India has never entirely gone out of fashion. Rather than look back to the woefully absurd etymologies that Jacolliot came up with, we can find very similar linguistic atrocities in a book published in 2000 by someone called Stephen Knapp, who continues Jacolliot's tradition. Just one instance of Knapp's imagination. The names of many countries still show their roots in the Vedic culture. Australia comes from the Vedic term Astralaya. Lyre, he says, means land, and Astra, missile, gives us Australia. It may have gotten this name, he says, for being the practicing place for the Brahmastra missiles that had been used in the Ramayana and Mahabharata wars. These missiles may have caused the destruction of the land and formed the deserts of Australia. There is obviously a scale to be drawn of imagined Hinduisms, with Jacolliot and Knapp at one end. But there should be a twofold scale. Imaginary Hinduisms that bear no contact with reality, that fade away to nothing, or ought to so fade away, and those that take life and become dominant. There are true imaginings and there are false imaginings. But it's now time to look in more detail, finally, at Ganesha, who has been sitting up above us, benevolently waiting for us to return our attention to him. Our picture of Ganesha is taken from the dust jacket of a book. Ganesha is a baby crawling on the ground, one knee and one hand on the ground, naked, the lovable innocence of a baby soon to become a toddler. Most of his weight is taken by his right hand, and he leans over precariously towards the viewer. His other hand holds the fruit that he plucks at with his trunk. Ganesha, Lord of Obstacles, Lord of Beginnings. This particular image, of course, forms the cover of the book of that name by Paul Courtright, reprinted by Motilal Banarsidass in 2001. It was first published by OUP in 1985. On the 29th of October of this year, Motilal withdrew the book from publication in response to a petition originating from Hindus at Courtwright's University, Emory, in Georgia, USA. The petition asked the book to be withdrawn on the grounds that it had a nude cover picture and insulting interpretations. In fact, the petition specified the author and the publisher to give an unequivocal apology to Hindus, the author to expunge the above and other offensive passages and to revise the book with clarifications and corrections, and thirdly, publisher to immediately withdraw the book from circulation, and the author to stop the use of this book in academics. Probably means academies. But here are the passages. Here are some of the passages referred to in the petition. Ganesha's trunk is the displaced phallus, a caricature of Shiva's linga. It poses no threat because it is too large, flaccid, and in the wrong place to be useful for sexual purposes, from page 121. Ganesha remains celibate so as not to compete erotically with his father, a notorious womanizer, either incestuously for his mother or for any other woman in that matter. So Ganesha takes on the attributes of his father, but in an inverted form, with an exaggerated limp phallus, ascetic and benign, whereas Shiva is a hard urdhvalinga, erotic and destructive. The problem here is that the petitioners seem not to be familiar with one group of the sacred, though not very sacred, texts of modernity, namely the works of Freud, nor with the Shaiva Puranas. Shiva and Ganesha must find all this rather amusing. More alarming, perhaps, than the criticisms of Courtwright's Freudian interpretations is the finding fault with a naked image of Ganesha. Here is not simply ignorance of a type of interpretation that has several eminent Indian exponents, but a scary Talibanization. Here we have a baby Ganesha modelled on baby Krishna, the adorable male child as divine, an innovative image, and one in itself plainly showing adoration of Ganesha. Courtwright points out that he did not choose this image for the new edition of his book. The US cover, he says, depicted a clothed Ganesha dancing, an image drawn from a sculpture on display at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But it does transpire that this, or at least some Ganesha figures in American galleries, have on their brief exhibition labels similar quotations from Courtwright's Freudian readings of the gods. This is surely not appropriate and could well be offensive to some or many people. Rajiv Malhotra, whose webpage often attacks Western academic interpreters of Hinduism, is also right, I think, to complain about some treatments of Hinduism in Western encyclopedias. Equally dignified treatment should be accorded religions in general works of reference. However, in the case of the other major religions, generally accepted positions backed by sound scholarship are more readily to be found. In the case of Hinduism, the problem of taking an overview is very much greater. We have already then the Freudian Courtwright imagination at work, and also the imagination of the objectors. Malhotra, for instance, who wants a spiritual Hinduism free from sexual connotations, free, in fact, from mythology, and probably cognizant of what he sees as a scientific, or at least inner science, basis of Hinduism. Allied with the problem of Ganesha is the problem of the linga, which Malhotra and many other Hindus prefer not to associate with the phallus. The problem with Hinduism is the richness of its history, the huge variety of texts and artifacts. Those who wish for a compact and narrow faith to rival the monotheisms from the Near East have to close their eyes to many things to reach their goal. A very popular image in Western presentations of Hinduism is that of the Chola bronze Nataraja, an image that is free, I think, from Western interpretations alarming to Hindus, though Gupta and other earlier versions, had Shiva as ithyphallic in his dance. It's interesting to remember that it was not until Kumaraswamy brought photographs of the Chola bronze to the West that the image had any impact here, despite a few drawings of it being published in earlier centuries. An essential feature of this complex and multiply dynamic Murti is the contrast the supporting figure of Apismara offers to the deity, with its own connotations of possession and delusion, and indeed of human as contrasted with divine. Shiva himself exemplifies the transcendent transformation of the altered state of consciousness that holds Apismara in its grip, but the one supports the other, the two go together. We might also remember here the Chidambaram myth of the origin of the dance, where Vishnu takes on the form of Mohini in a dreamlike substitution, and where the sages use the magic power of their mantras to attack Shiva, an attack that is transformed into his iconographic details, the snake, the tiger skin, and so on. Here, Shiva is the stark naked and very handsome ascetic who arouses the lust of the married ascetic's wives in a Shaiva transposition of Krishna's erotic prowess. A bizarre variation of this image is found on the cover of an important book on modern Hinduism by Lisa McKean, Divine Enterprise. A modern sculptor there has represented dancing Shiva as an acrobat, standing on one hand, the hand that usually points down to the raised foot that offers salvation. The other hands perform their usual functions, holding the drum and the flame and signalling do not fear. But the feet that should offer salvation and should tread down the demon ignorance are up in the air. This topsy-turvy image is a vivid emblem of the way the title sets out to show that religion is business and the profit motive underlies everything. I find this modern image a disturbing distortion, and McKean's account of modern gurus deeply unsympathetic, though containing some useful information. Even in the case of undistorted images, there is the question of the aesthetic dimension. Some images are more beautiful than others, or, as to better phrase it, better present the beauty of the deity. One particularly unsatisfactory image comes to mind. It figures in a scene from Robert Eagle's 1995 documentary film, Guru Busters. T.N. Seshan, at the time the Electoral Commissioner of India, talks of his belief in Satya Sai Baba's miracles, notwithstanding his own degree in physics and business administration, the latter from Harvard. Seated beside a good-sized modern image of Nataraja, and with another smaller one on the background behind him, he shows a large ring composed of 9 gems that was, he tells us, produced out of thin air by the godman. The version of Nataraja beside Seshan is ugly and clumsy. That, of course, is merely my personal view, though a view I could substantiate by comparison with other images, the way the foot points sideways rather than curving down to the worshipper, the coarse expression on the face, the clumsiness of the headdress. What matters, of course, is the eye, the mind, the imagination of the worshipper, rather than the mere physical form of the image. For the devotee, the image represents the ideal, it is the ideal. Only the Chola emperors had the means and the will to encourage the greatest artists to the greatest versions of the bronze. The ordinary devotee has to make do with what they can get. The image is only a prompt for the imagination to reconstitute the perfect image in the mind. But the use of this particular still from the film calls perhaps for further comment. While I was thinking about Nataraja, the scene came into my mind. Perhaps it came into my mind because Sai Baba's birthday is on Sunday. Perhaps Seshan displaying his ring with 9 gems reminded me of Kalidasa, who was one of the 9 gems of Vikramaditya's court. Sai Baba's production of gems, necklaces, sacred ash from thin air is relevant to a consideration of the imagination. As an instance of divine creation, of the divine imagination that produced the universe, bringing itself to bear microcosmically, Sai Baba has recently restarted his practice of manifesting Shivalingams for Shivaratri, producing them as part of his divine leela from his mouth. On another level, as Lee Siegel so well shows in his account of Indian magic, conjurers owe their success in large measure to the ability of the audience to see what the audience wants to see. Sai Baba first claimed to be an incarnation of Sirdi Sai Baba, but later, more boldly, to be Shiva and Shakti combined. And at this juncture, I turn to the centrepiece of this lecture, Ganesha's parents themselves, Shiva and Shakti, Shiva and Parvati, the mother and father of the world. For images, we could have their wedding in sculptured reliefs from Cave 21 or Cave 14 at Ellora, say, or their conjoined form as half lord, half woman. But for the detailed working of the imagination on this event, we should look at Kalidasa's Kumarasambhava, the birth of the war god, Ganesha's brother. The part of the poem written by Kalidasa ends with the lovemaking of Shiva and Parvati after their wedding, before the birth the title heralds. Kalidasa, the Sanskrit poet, the Indian Shakespeare, is a devotee of Shiva, as the Mangala shlokas of his works reveal. Kalidasa is the embodiment of the Hindu golden age, And from a religious point of view, Kumarasambhava is his most important work, where we see his imagination active in the world of the gods. And I want to spend some time on the way his imagination works as a very significant instance of the Hindu imagination. In Kumarasambhava, after an opening surga, note that the word for chapter or canto in a Sanskrit court epic is surga, creation. After an opening surga sketching the mountain Himalaya, the growth to beauty of Himalaya's daughter Parvati, and Shiva practicing yoga on a Himalayan peak, while his gunas, crowned with flowers, repose nearby on lichen-covered rock slabs, and his haughty bull scrapes at the ice with his hooves, after this opening surga we get a dramatic account of the meeting of the lesser gods with Brahma. After their hymn of praise to Brahma, Kalidasa's brilliant imaginative realism gets underway again. Brahma, hearing from them truthful praises which pleased his heart, the creator inclined to be gracious. Like anyone else, Brahma is pleased and won over by words of praise. There is kindly concern in his word, in his question, "How is it that your faces do not bear their customary glow?" to the gods. Even Yama's, the god of death, even Yama's rod has lost its lustre. He scratches the earth with it and values it, infallible though it used to be, no more than a burnt-out torch. And how have those Adityas, sun gods, cold from the destruction of their fiery might, become easy for anybody to look at as if they were put in a painting? That the Rudras' menacing howls are silenced, their bowed heads show. The matted locks that form their crowns droop down, their crescent moons drop off. These vivid pictures, even though pictures are said to be inadequate, become easy for anybody to look at as if they were put in a painting, come to a wonderfully humorous climax in the comparison of the gods to grammatical rules. Have you, who first attained high position, been overthrown by more powerful foes, as general grammatical rules are circumvented by exceptions? So tell me, dear boys, what you've come here to ask me for. Creation of the worlds is invested in me, protection in you. Here the wise old man tells the impotent gods, that in fact, that there's nothing he can do for them. What he does is create. It is their job to protect. We have a gloriously lifelike picture of realpolitik, with the gods defeated and the wily old Brahma sympathetic but washing his hands of the problem. Following on this reduction of the gods to grammatical rules, this rhetorical wiping out of the power of the gods, we will get an account of their defeat by the demon Taraka. But the very next verse hammers home their inadequacy and their leader's inadequacy in his reduction to a flower. Then Indra, leader of the beneficent gods, with his thousand eyes shining, like a lotus bed shaken by a gentle wind, prompted Brihaspati to speak. After the exploits of the demon have been set out, and Brahma explains that only a son of Shiva can be the general they need to defeat Taraka, there is a wonderfully realistic and humorous account of Indra's meeting with Karma, the Indian Cupid. There Indra, the chastiser of Parka, decided on Kandarpa, god of love, and went to him in his mind at the double in his haste for the success of the mission. Then Karma, slinging over his neck, marked by Rati's bracelets, his bow, but leaving his arrows of mango buds entrusted to the hands of his companion Spring, flower-bowed love stood before Indra of 100 sacrifices, hands respectfully joined. Leaving the 30 gods, Indra's thousand eyes fell on him all at the same time. The respect masters pay to their dependents generally varies according to consideration of their usefulness. Given a place by Indra with the words, "Sit here next to my throne," he accepted his master's favour with a bow of his head and began to speak confidentially to him as follows. "You who know the various ways of men, tell me what you want me to do. I wish the favour you've done me by remembering me to be increased by your command." Karma, like a practised courtier, sits close to Indra and eagerly offers to do for him whatever he wants done. He gets so carried away by his sales pitch for his services that he declares that not even Shiva is safe from his bow. "By your favour, though my weapons are flowers, taking just one friend Spring, I will make even Shiva the destroyer. Shiva, who has the Pinaka bow in his hand, lose his concentration. What are other bowmen to me?" Then, lowering his foot from his thigh to the footstool, which was honoured by its touch, Indra spoke as follows to Karma, who declared his capability for the task Indra had in mind. This change of position on the part of Indra shows the genius of Kalidasa the dramatist, Kalidasa as cameraman, we might say, Indra's body language revealing his gratification at the course events have taken in this interview with the rash young daredevil Karma, and movement of his foot from thigh to footstool that was honoured by its touch reminds us too that this is a king who, for the ends of his own, had put aside his high status for the moment, the better to encourage his courtier in a very dangerous enterprise. Indra explains that only a son of Shiva can defeat the foe, and that Parvati is waiting on Shiva while he practices yoga. With the word "so be it," Karma the intoxicator received his master's command like a garland on his head, and as he set off, Indra touched his body with his hand roughened from stroking his elephant Airavata. Once again, the body language of Indra brings the scene wonderfully to life, here with details beyond the scope of camera or paint. Indra gives him his bodily approval by this physical contact. We also get a vivid physical detail of Indra's body. His hand is roughened from striking his elephant. In a more subtle way, he is also commanding and controlling the reckless Karma in the same sort of way as he does his elephant. And then, of course, the fire from Shiva's eye destroys Karma, and he's just a pile of ashes. Rati, his wife, faints. The ascetic who, this is Shiva, the ascetic who suddenly smashed his asceticism's interruption as a thunderbolt destroys a tree, wished to avoid the presence of women and disappeared with his creatures, he, the lord of creatures. The mountain's daughter, judging that her lofty father's wish and her winsome body were pointless, and all the more ashamed that it happened in front of her two friends, feeling empty, somehow or other went off in the direction of her home. While her eyes were still closed, in fear of Rudra's rage, the mountain quickly took in his arms his pitiful daughter, like Indra's elephant with a lotus clinging to his tusk, and dashed along the path, his body lengthened by his speed. Note the brilliant psychological realism of Shiva's annoyance with female company at this point, and even more, perhaps, the realism of Parvati being all the more ashamed that it happened in front of her two friends. And the scintillating visual imagination that sees the mountain's body being lengthened by his speed as he sweeps Parvati away, as in some Walt Disney cartoon. Utterly brilliant is the subsequent displacement of the emotional force of events from the principal characters to Rati, Karma's wife. "Aye, Lord of my life, you still alive," she said as she got up. She saw in front of her on the ground only the ashes of the fire of the anger of Shiva the destroyer, ashes in the shape of a man. Then once again distraught, her breasts dirty from embracing the earth, she wailed, dishevelling her hair, seeming to make the earth feel her pain. So much for Rati, Karma's wife. After a whole surga devoted to her lament for the dead Karma, comes the iron determination of Parvati as she practices asceticism, where again Kalidasa, notwithstanding the flowery style of court poetry, achieves graphic realism. At the end of her fast, she didn't seek water, drinking only what came to her, rain that fell, and the liquid rays of the moon. And, extremely heated by a twofold fire, by the sun and by fuel-fed fire, at the end of the hot season, drenched with fresh showers, she, along with the earth, gave off steam. Pausing a moment on her eyelashes, beating against her lower lip, breaking up in the fall onto the protrusion of her breasts, slithering into the three folds of skin above her navel, the first drops of water eventually reached the navel. Sleeping on stone, not dwelling in a house, amid ceaseless rain and intermittent wind, the knights seemed witnesses of her great asceticism as they looked upon her with their glances formed by lightning. This surga concludes with the dramatic encounter with a young ascetic who slanders Shiva but then turns out to be Shiva, of course, after Parvati has boldly declared her love of Shiva. I'll skip the details of the wedding preparations and the wedding itself, which are very finely drawn and extremely vivid, just as if Kalidasa was there actually watching the events. So I'll skip all that and Parvati's shyness as the newly wedded wife, and then to just give you the last verse of Surga 7. Then there Gauri felt Parvati felt the shyness that is the ornament of the newly wedded wife, turning away her face even as he lifted it up, only with difficulty giving her two friends who used to sleep beside her permission to retire. Lord Shiva made her laugh in secret with the facial contortions of his attendant gunners. Now, in many manuscripts, the poem ends with the seventh surga, and some believe the eighth, as well as the 9 to 17, is not the work of Kalidasa. And, of course, the surga that follows, surga 8, is devoted to the lovemaking of Shiva and Parvati. We have, in fact, a parallel from Hinduism's golden age to the problem that confronts us today, the problem of improper treatment of the Hindu gods. Let me just give the last three verses of the poem to give the savour of this final surga. Impassioned on beholding his beloved's face, red eyes as she was from lack of sleep, lower lip lacerated from deep tooth marks, hair dishevelled, tilaka mark removed, he made love to her. When night had ended and the day was bright, he did not leave the bed, its coverlet creased and uneven, streaked with red dye from their feet. In the middle, her girdle with its cord snapped, made into a lump. Actually, I couldn't help thinking of Tracy Henning's bed then. But wishing night and day to enjoy the taste of his beloved's mouth, the taste that increased his thirst, when Vijaya, the maid, informed him of the presence of people wanting to see him, he made himself invisible to them. For Shiva absorbed there, night and day the same, 150 years went by like one night, his thirst for the pleasures of copulation unsated, as is the submarine fire amid the ocean's waters. The surga, and that's where the poem ends. The surga lovingly dwells on Parvati's transformation from timidity to what is classified in the manual of the science of sexual pleasure as the Mugdha Nayaka, to Madhya Nayaka, and finally to Pragalbha Nayaka, fully experienced and bold in love. Almost all the poeticians find fault with Kalidasa penning a description of the lovemaking of the gods. Though the greatest of them, Ananda Rodhana, says that Kalidasa's skill, his imaginative power, prevents it from being obscene, vulgar, well, really rustic is the term, gramya. It's not rustic, or folk. Folk would be better still, in a sense, is a way of fitting in folk. Commenting on Ananda Rodhana, Abhinavagupta is unable to go all the way with him. Now, treating the sexual enjoyment of the highest gods is like treating that of our parents. Shame and horror will leave us no room for delight. But, by Kalidasa in the Kumara Sambhava, even sexual enjoyment is there so described by the imagination of the poet that our heart fixes on the description itself without any careful weighing of the context. Just as when a brave man is engaged in a battle, even if it be in a wrong cause, we applaud him at that moment, says Abhinavagupta, but not when we later consider the matter carefully. But though the poeticians here, as often in other respects too, antipathetic to imaginative boldness on the part of a poet, the eighth surga, the description of Shiva and Parvati's lovemaking, is the most quoted surga of the poem and the most influential on other poets. I should point out that Kalidasa's description of the lovemaking of the mother and father of the universe makes no reference whatsoever to their sexual organs. However, the omnipresence of the lotus in Sanskrit court poetry bears some relationship to obsession with the vagina and the womb. Remember that Indra's thousand-eye lotuses were originally vaginas. Certainly the most pervasive idiom in court poetry for veiled reference to human copulation is that of the male bee tasting the female lotus flower. The ever-growing use of the court in the court epic after Kalidasa of the lotus as staple of comparison, not least for bodily parts, feet, hands, face, eye, makes it possible to argue that Kavya, in seeking to create court poetry, in seeking to create, as it does, a perfect world, regresses to the womb that is the lotus. A striking instance occurs near the end of Kalidasa's other court epic, the Raghuvamsa, where the lineage of Raghu nearly comes to an unworthy end in the recent King Agnivarna, whose debauchery controverts the idealism of the rest of the poem. Besotted with his harem, he avoided his subjects, not unlike, in fact, the close of the Kumara Sambhava, where Shiva makes himself invisible when anyone wants to see him. But when King Agnivarna's advisers did prevail upon him to show himself to his subjects, he would show the red lotus that was his foot from the palace window before which his subjects bowed down. Apropos of the complexity of the symbolism of the lotus, I must also mention another verse which puts the lotus where we might expect the linga. In art, Shiva, when practicing asceticism, has often been shown as ithyphallic. Now, human and divine sex organs are not directly referred to in Kavya, so that one would not expect Kalidasa to refer to Shiva as ithyphallic. But even so, there is a startling power in this description, in his description of Shiva having a lotus between his legs. In the third surga, after the description of the coming of spring to the forest, we are confronted by Shiva sitting upright in the Virasana posture. His hands upturned in his lap resemble a full-blown blue lotus. This stately flower is at first sight just another instance of the burgeoning nature all around with the coming of spring. But there are also the resonances of the lotuses of the internal chakras and the thousand-petaled lotus on the head in this turning of Shiva's hands into a lotus, and also the emphatic emphasis, emphatic absence of the linga passed over in silence. T.G. Vaidyanath and Jeffrey Kripal, in their important Reader in Psychoanalysis and Hinduism, both refer to a comment that Aurobindo made about psychoanalysis. Quote, Aurobindo said, "I find it difficult to take these psychoanalysts at all seriously when they try to scrutinize spiritual experience by the flicker of their torchlights. Yet perhaps one ought to, for half knowledge can be a great obstacle to the true truth. They look from down up and explain the higher lights by the lower obscurities. But, says Aurobindo, the superconscient, not the subconscient, is the true foundation of things." The significance of the lotus, says Aurobindo, is not to be found by analysing the secrets of the mud from which it grows. Its secret is to be found in the heavenly archetype of the lotus that blooms forever in the light above. Of course, Kripal points out that Aurobindo's statement virtually deconstructs itself for us. And Kripal says, "We might reasonably ask how anyone could hope to understand something as biological as a lotus without first beginning with the larger ecosystem, that is, with the secrets of the mud in which it grows. Put bluntly, there is just no such thing as a mudless lotus. We need not and should not end with the mud, but we certainly need to at least begin there," says Kripal. If psychoanalytically inclined thinkers, he says, then can be accused of concentrating too much on the mud of pathology, the body and the libidinal drives, mystics such as Aurobindo can be accused of concentrating too much on solipsistic, sexless lotuses growing out of nothing. End of quote. Kripal is only too aware that Hindus sometimes find the conclusions of psychoanalysis offensive to their own self-perceptions and cultural understandings. And indeed, of course, his perceptive reinterpretation of Ramakrishna's life has aroused strong opposition amongst many Hindus. But he points out that the offensiveness is inevitable. Quote, "Freud, after all, believed that censorship was also something internal to the human psyche, that the human mind censors itself. It is the task of the analyst to read mental phenomena as half appearances whose full meanings must be deciphered and read out of the unconscious and the body from which they always arise. Rejections of such findings is inevitable, at least in the first instance." End of quote from Kripal. I would add that Indian thought can accommodate with ease the notion of the subconscious, inasmuch as our immense, our infinite histories as reincarnating selves make us all repositories of infinite experience. According to Kalidasa in the Shakuntala, it is beautiful things and sweet sounds which evoke memories of former lives. But this is too restrictive. Beauty evokes nice memories, but there are all sorts of sanskaras, all sorts of memories, and all sorts of symbols. Symbols, it may be argued, are a form of contact with the subconscious, with the traces of previous lives. Yogic pratibhara is perhaps the only surefire way of remembering previous lives, but symbols can open up hidden depths when we have learned to read them, when they awaken our imagination. We might apply here a verse that Ananda Vardhana quotes from the Gita, as it happens shortly before discussing Sirga 8 of Kumarasambhava. "In what is night to all creatures, the true ascetic awakes. When others wake, the sage who sees that it is night." Remembering again the Krishna-inspired version of Ganesha, which we started, which please have it keep in your minds, let us close with the connection between Krishna and Ganesha made by the sometimes Freudian anthropologist Abhayasekara. Abhayasekara makes a telling link between the boyish Ganesha and the baby Krishna in two stories which reveal, he says, the centrality of the mother-child relationship in Hindu myth. "We've been considering the picture of Ganesha as a toddler, but even when a big boy, he is not inclined to move fast. His rat is hardly a competent vehicle. Shiva, of course, offers his sons the prize of a mango for the first one to go round the world. Skanda, the war god, dashes off on his peacock, while Ganesha slowly ambles round his mother and father and claims the prize. The race was indeed to be first round the world, but Ganesha explains that his parents are the world. This is especially true of Shiva and Parvati, since they created the universe, but also true, Abhayasekara argues, of the human parents from the point of view of the human child. And that story, Abaya Sekera finds, is complemented by the story of Yashodhara seeing the whole world within the mouth of the baby Krishna. The other boys tell her that he's been eating earth. He denies this. And when she gets him to open wide his mouth, she sees the whole world in it. Abaya Sekera sees this story as showing not only the divinity of Krishna, but also that the human baby boy in general is the whole world from the perspective of the mother. The whole life of the woman, quote, her universe is centered on her firstborn son. Mouth, he says, is highly appropriate since it is the organ that connects the mother in early infancy with the child. Says Abaya Sekera, is the universe of the mother in this early symbolic relationship on the level of myth. The full understanding of Ganesha and Krishna is surely inseparable from a full understanding of the human family. Word and meaning are bound together like Shiva and Parvati, but sometimes in their mythology, their relationship has dynamic variations. Parvati may become Kali, Shiva may make Parvati jealous because of the Ganga he carries in his hair. So too, the interrelationship of word and meaning is not entirely without interruptions and complexities, and is subject to the imagination. I conclude.